Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. With the former rivals for the Democratic presidential nomination standing together on stage in New Hampshire today, we will begin with the belated endorsement of Hillary Clinton by Bernie Sanders. Joining us is Neil Schroeker, who is the Communications Director for Democracy for America, whose members contributed $2 million to the Sanders campaign after 88% of its over 1 million members had enthusiastically endorsed the Vermont senator's presidential campaign. We will discuss the endorsement today of Hillary Clinton by Democracy for America, which has raised more than $32.7 million to elect 843 progressive candidates nationwide, and the organization's statement that we're backing Hillary Clinton because she gives our country the opportunity to smash one of the last great glass ceilings and will be the partner we need in the White House to realize the agenda that Bernie Sanders' political revolution fought for in the primaries, from tuition-free college to Social Security expansion. Then we'll examine the ruling handed down by the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea in The Hague today that finds China has no historical rights to the waters or the resources in the South China Sea and is violating the Philippines' sovereign rights with its military and territorial buildup on the disputed reefs and islands. Alfred McCoy, who holds the Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and is the author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, joins us to discuss China's angry denouncement of the ruling and the muted response from the new president of the Philippines, who appears to have been bought off by the Chinese. Then finally, we'll look into the internal split in the NRA over its response to recent shootings and the danger and confusion that the open carry laws in Texas created for the Dallas police, who were recently under fire from a sniper who killed five officers and wounded seven others. John Donahue, a professor of law at Stanford Law School and the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis, joins us to discuss the impact that the open carry law in Ohio will have on next week's Republican convention in Cleveland. And joining us now is Neil Schroeker, who's the Communication Director of Democracy for America. Previously, he was the Progressive Change Campaigns Committee's press secretary, and he has served in the Obama administration as the Director of New Media at the U.S. Department of Commerce and ran social media projects for MoveOn.org and managed new media for Barack Obama's primary campaigns in South Carolina and Ohio. Welcome to Background Briefing, Neil Schroeker.
Great to be here with you.
And Neil, your organization, which has really been at the forefront of supporting Bernie Sanders, the Democracy for America, today endorsed Hillary Clinton. So let's talk about what happened today in New Hampshire. How did that event of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders standing together with him endorsing her, how did that strike you?
I mean, I think the important thing to note is that Democracy for America's endorsement in this race comes from a couple of different angles. You know, number one, when we did our endorsement poll back in December, the one that had us endorsing Bernie Sanders with a vote of nearly over 88% of our membership, we said, before we even conducted the vote, that we were going to support the Democratic nominee in the fall because the stakes were just too high. And our members really understood that. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why, even though Bernie Sanders was a long shot, I don't think we realized he would end up winning 22 states. I think that's why they awarded him, you know, DFA's endorsement, you know, because they knew that no matter what, we were going to be in it to make sure that whether it was Donald Trump or somebody else, we would fight against them. So number one, we were delivering on that promise today. But number two, and I think this speaks to what Bernie Sanders has been able to accomplish over the course of his campaign, but especially over the last few weeks, is we've seen some really important smart moves from Hillary Clinton's campaign after Bernie Sanders started reaching out to her after the primaries were over. And we saw some big changes on, you know, tuition-free college, something that she had opposed during the primary. She listened to Bernie Sanders, and she changed her, you know, policy position on that. She also reiterated her commitment to fighting for a public option to health, to Obamacare, something, you know, that gets us closer to the kind of Medicare for all that Bernie Sanders is talking about. It's the kind of the direct stepping stone to that.
Right. So, and by the way, Barack Obama today came out for that very public option.
Yeah, my joke when I saw that was, man, it would have been great if he had decided to fight for that a little bit harder and taken on Ben Nelson when he killed it 6 years ago. But here we are today.
Right. Well, you live and learn, you know. I think he's probably learned a few things in the last 7 years.
I think that's true.
Sonia, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Oh, no, that's fine. And so we delivered on our promise that we were going to support the Democrat nominee. We saw real changes in the platform. And, you know, I think the important thing to remember is that, part of, so many folks, I'm in Washington today. Normally I live just outside Detroit. But we spent the last 6-7 months raging against this Washington, D.C. establishment that just kept on wondering, why isn't Bernie Sanders getting out of the race after, California or after the D.C. primary was over? And now we know the answer, especially over the last few weeks. He was staying in this race to make sure not only do we have the most progressive Democratic platform ever, but that we have a candidate who's leading her campaign fighting on some of the big populist progressive issues that Bernie Sanders brought forward. That's what, short of winning the nomination, that's what victory looks like. We felt it was really important to join with Bernie Sanders, stand with him, and say, we're going to declare victory, and we're going to support Hillary Clinton so she can fight on those things. We can defeat Donald Trump, and then after the election, we can hold her accountable for the things she said she was going to fight for in the White House.
Well, clearly, the majority of your more than 1 million members enthusiastically supported the Vermont Senator's presidential campaign. And the issue here, and the reason I'm talking to you, Neil, is because I want to get a sense of how that support for Bernie Sanders is going to migrate to Hillary Clinton, given the passionate nature of the support, some of the bitterness from the fight. That was a bruising battle. And clearly, Bernie Sanders himself is tough when you've been fighting all your life. You're 74 years old, and suddenly you bring out all these people. I mean, I think it came to as big a surprise to him as it did to anybody else.
And
you want to keep that kind of enthusiasm and spirit alive. So to give us a sense of how do you think this is going to go down, your endorsement, since you're a progressive organization that previously supported Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I mean, not only that, DFA has some real experience. We were founded by Governor Dean after he lost the presidential nomination. Now, it's important to note, Bernie Sanders was more successful by an order of magnitude, by 22 times more successful. You know, Howard Dean only won one state, Bernie Sanders won 22. I think that, DFA was founded after Howard Dean lost the presidential race, and here we are 12 years later talking about the $1.8 million we just helped raise, one of the most progressive presidential candidates we've ever seen, ever run. We've helped DFA members help fill over 150,000 individual volunteer phone call shifts. So 12 years later, even being 22 times less successful than Bernie Sanders, we're still here and we're still making a tremendous impact, not just on the country, but on the Democratic Party. And I think that that's what Bernie Sanders is going to do. I think that's what he's lined himself up to do over the course of the 2016 race. But honestly, the thing that excites me even more is what Bernie Sanders supporters are going to do in 2018, in 2020. Because if you recall, a couple of weeks ago when Bernie Sanders did his meeting with his supporters, online video, he asked all of them to run for office themselves. And I can't wait to see tens of thousands of Bernie Sanders supporters over the next few years, and it's going to be a long time. It's not a one-off. It's not this year. It's not next year. It's not even the cycle after. It's going to be a long period of time. I can't wait to see all of them run and win in party office and elected office and see what they do, not just to transform the Democratic Party, because I think they're going to do that. I think we're already doing that, frankly. But I think they're going to change the role of elected officials in American politics. Because that's what Bernie Sanders has wanted them to do since the very beginning. He said that his campaign is not about me, it's about us. And now is the time where we find and try to work together to empower us to lick our wounds a little bit from not winning this primary, but realize the success that we've had and figure out how we're going to build from it. And I, you know, seeing how DFA has thrived, I know that whatever comes from Bernie Sanders' campaign going forward is going to be pretty tremendous.
And Bernie Sanders today, standing on the stage in New Hampshire with Hillary Clinton in endorsing her, said, in these stressful times for our country, this election must be about bringing our people together, not dividing us up. While Donald Trump is busy insulting Mexicans, Muslims, women, African Americans, and veterans, Hillary Clinton understands that our diversity is one of our greatest strengths. Yes, we will become stronger when black and white, Latino, Asian American, Native American, all of us stand together. Yes, we become stronger when men and women, young and old, gay and straight, native-born and immigrant, fight to rid this country of all forms of bigotry. Now, you know, Bernie Sanders is one of the reasons that I think the young were so attracted to him is because of his authenticity. And he's been fighting this fight for a long time. And it's worth reminding our audience that he's not actually a Democrat. He's the longest-serving independent in the history of the United States Congress. So, you know, we need that kind of rhetoric and that passion. Do you think it's going to be out there on the stump? I mean, Elizabeth Warren's been stumping for Hillary. So what's your understanding or prediction of how much Bernie's going to work hard and stump?
You know, what I expect is that he's going to campaign for Secretary Clinton on the issues that have driven his campaign. I don't expect him to just go out and stump or be a surrogate and just say whatever comes to mind. I think he's going to speak in the only way I think Bernie Sanders knows how, which is authentically and from the heart. And I think he's going to say a lot of what he said today, which is to spell out, as you just, you know, reading a quote from him, spell out exactly what the stakes are on the other side of this election. And make no mistake, a lot of Democrats talk about how they think this is going to be a slam dunk against Donald Trump. It's not. And the stakes are so, so high. This is a man who has used bigotry against Mexicans and Muslims and women and all people of color, and is using it in one of the most divisive ways that we can imagine, and trying to advance a set of the same policy agenda that Republicans have been trying to advance for decades. So it's a nightmare.
Right, but Neil, we've seen from the Brexit vote that Obama went over to the UK specifically to urge young people in the United Kingdom to vote against leaving the EU.
Yeah.
Because he knew that overwhelmingly young people in the UK supported being in Europe. Yet they didn't show up. So this is the concern. Just in the last minute, what do you think is going to happen in terms of Bernie's ability to get these young people to show up?
Part of it is it's not just about Bernie. It's also about Secretary Clinton's campaign. The thing that's going to make Bernie Sanders' endorsement truly successful is if Secretary Clinton embraces and continues to run on the bold, populist, progressive ideas that motivated him. You know, things like if tuition-free college is a centerpiece of her campaign and in an authentic way, and Bernie Sanders helps her bring that authenticity, then she can win. If things like Social Security expansion, which she's talked about, become the centerpiece of her campaign, I think she can get people excited. And the same with the public option. I think if the campaign is about those issues and she continues to fight for those things, not just in the primary, but in the general election, I think people can get excited. And Bernie Sanders can explain to them that it's not just about an anti-Trump choice, but a choice, a fight for an agenda and a chance to win on some of these things and live to fight another day.
Well, Neil Schroeker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Of course.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Neil Schroeker, who's the Communications Director of Democracy for America, and previously he was the Progressive Change Campaign Committee's Press Secretary. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining the ruling handed down against China by the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea.
You don't need to change the futures are. You don't need to change.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Alfred McCoy, who holds the Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the editor of Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, America's Decline, and is the author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, among other works. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alfred McCoy.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And we spoke earlier about the claims or the disputed claims that China has to the South China Sea and the role of the Philippines and Vietnam in trying to counter this expansion of Chinese territorial claims. The UN Tribunal, set up under the UN Law of the Seas, has ruled against China, but almost immediately the Chinese state media have reacted angrily to the verdict, saying it's ill-founded and naturally null and void. And then the People's Daily editorial says that the tribunal has ignored basic truths and trampled on international laws and norms. So that is to, I guess one assumes, even though China,
including its editorial, saying that the decision by the permanent tribunal in The Hague was null and void and ignored international law. And he concluded that we hope the people's naval and land forces are ready to assert themselves should the United States and Japan intervene in China's claim, China's sovereign claim over the South China Sea. So China is very clear that China is going to ignore this decision. And I think that's the major takeaway from this. The dispute's going to roll on for a very long time. We're going to see more U.S. freedom of navigation cruises through the South China Sea. We'll probably see some incidents of Chinese aircraft flying very close to U.S. ships or U.S. aircraft. They'll continue to keep Filipino fishermen at bay. On the Philippine-China side, there's no possibility of military conflict. China has over 2,000 operating jet fighters. The Philippines has, I think, at this point, zero operating jet fighters. and the navies have comparable balance of forces as well. But what's really significant here is that China looks like, for the first time since it's entered the international community about 20 years ago, that it's now achieved enough power, it's become enough of an empire, to where China can now decide which of the international directives it will accept and which it will refuse. And the German fascist political thinker, Carl Schmitt, who was a rather clever thinker, actually, said something quite famous. He said, "The sovereign is he who decides the exception." And he was applying that, of course, to Hitler and the German history of German politics. But if we think about the world as a global community, and great imperial powers as the sovereign powers, the dominant powers that decide what are the norms of the international community and further decide whether or not they are going to obey them or take an exception. And China has now emerged as a strong enough power on the international stage where in the major zone of international conflict, China can decide that it will exercise the exceptional authority of an empire, of a world empire. And that's a major change.
Well, of course, China has tried to sort of woo the non-aligned countries and has tried to play a role as a global power as being largely about helping developed nations trade and not to interfere in their domestic affairs. And this new attitude would certainly undercut that. Do you think they will suffer any diplomatic damage, or will they just, resort to checkbook diplomacy in the neighborhood? It looks like they've already bought off the new Philippines president.
It turns out this decision was pushed by the last administration. The Philippine government filed this case in front of the Permanent Tribunal in The Hague back in 2013. At that time, the president of the Philippines was President Ninoy Aquino, who spent part of his childhood in the United States, was very pro-American, absorbed very strong American view of international values, and pursued this case very, very strongly. The new president, President Duterte, is sort of an extraordinary individual, a strident nationalist in the mold of Trump or Boris Johnson or any one of those European types that are emerging now. He's at one point claimed to have been personally involved in 1,700 extrajudicial executions in his violent-ridden city of Davao in the southern Philippines. He now sort of disavows that a bit. But so he's a, you know, a tough-talking guy, and he broke with Aquino's position and is very friendly towards China. And I think in part because of investment and partly, I think, because of a personal stake in some of those investments that will probably grow with time as he stays in office. So the even the current administration in the Philippines is kind of backing away from that decision. But nonetheless, the court has ruled, and it is now international law. It's an enormously significant international decision. The well-known international barrister, Philip Sands, QC of London, has called this the second most important decision by the international court since they ruled 20 years ago against Pinochet. So, you know, this is a major national decision, and the United States and the international community can use this decision to challenge China's claim to sovereignty in the South China Sea. So instead of resolving the issue, I think what we've seen is now a basis for increased conflict over the South China Sea. China is not backing away, and the United States, which has taken a legalistic position towards this, the international community, Japan, the other major regional powers in the Asia-Pacific region, now have law on their side, so they don't have to back away. So we're going to see, I think, more and more confrontations and the possibility of some serious incidents in the near or medium term.
But when Philippe Sands says that this is the second major ruling of the UN tribunal in The Hague, citing Pinochet ruling against him as the president, that, of course, didn't work out that well in any case. And with a Philippine president who appears to be, he certainly has a violent past and is an extraordinary character to be a head of state. I imagine there's some nationalism at home about this ruling. But earlier, Scarborough Reef, which is very close to the Philippines, I think within 100 miles of the Philippines, which China is claiming, some years back, there was pressure to put a lighthouse on that the Philippine government was planning on doing to stake a claim before the Chinese military showed up and built structures and chased away the Filipino fishermen. My understanding is that some corrupt Filipino politician made a deal with the Chinese and they decided not to build the lighthouse, which would have made it sort of staked a claim, if you will. So do you have any understanding of that history, that the Filipinos essentially let that, they more or less, they were essentially foregoing sovereignty by negligence?
Sure. What happened is this, is that, you know, for nearly 100 years, the United States was both the formal and informal imperial power in the Philippines. From 1898 to 1945, it was a territory of the United States, and we, not too successfully, given World War II, were responsible for the defense of the Philippines. After the war, there was the Philippines and the United States negotiated a mutual defense treaty, and the United States erected a kind of a literal chain of defense to contain China, starting with its major air bases and marine air bases and naval bases in Japan, down through the Ryukyu Archipelago, Okinawa, which was still is an American military bastion, through Taiwan, the Philippines, all the way down to Australia. And that ended in 1992 when the Philippine Senate voted to cancel the U.S. leases on its major bases, particularly the base at Subic Bay, which was then the largest overseas U.S. naval installation anywhere in the world, massive bastion that the U.S. had built at the cost, in today's terms, of billions of dollars. And at that point, you know, the Philippines became responsible for exercising its sovereignty over its exclusive economic zone that extends nominally 200 miles from the Philippines, almost midway across the South China Sea. It's a vast area that's nearly half the size of the sovereign territory of the Philippines itself. And very critically, it's one of the world's five greatest fishing areas. There's more variety of fish in the South China Sea than anywhere else on the planet. It's one of the world's five greatest fishing grounds. And the Philippine diet, particularly among the poor, depends on protein from the sea. So this is very serious. Protein is one of two human nutrients needed for survival, carbohydrate and protein. And you have to have protein. And the Filipinos get that predominantly from the sea. So under President Fidel Ramos, the Philippine Congress, because of rising tensions with China, China moved in the midst of a typhoon and occupied a reef in 1994, and that was their first move into the South China Sea. So in order to protect the Philippine claim, the Fidel Ramos ordered a massive appropriation for an air force and a navy. Well, that appropriation never took place. And I think it was in 2005 that the last Filipino jet fighter could actually take off. They've run out of spare parts. And the Navy is also rusting away. So the Philippines simply didn't vote the funds to exercise territorial sovereignty. The patrols, the air installations, the radar, and all the rest you need to maintain an active claim. And that left the territory wide open for China to move in. Now, recently, okay, because the U.S. is now rebuilding its littoral of bases in the midst of President Obama's pivot from the Middle East to Southeast Asia, Obama's gone up and down that island chain, and we're building a massive new naval base in collaboration with the South Korean Navy on Jeju Island, which is going to be right astride the Yellow Sea. And then we also negotiated with Australia for rights in Darwin. We have a Marine battalion there and various U.S. Navy craft using that as a port. And recently, the Philippines and the United States, under the last administration, under President Aquino, the United States gained the right to build 5 military installations inside 5 Filipino bases, so it doesn't infringe upon the country's sovereignty. And that agreement is in place, and that base construction is ongoing. So there is it's complicated. There are now tensions within the Philippines over this previous commitment, and potential tensions between the Duterte administration and Washington, D.C. So this is a saga that's going to be playing out in a very complex and important way. And I think the takeaway is that we're now looking at, I think, the world's major tinderbox, the major arena on the planet where the two dominant superpowers can actually go to war. And this decision contributes to that rather than removes it.
Right. And the scenario under which that would happen is similar to the build-up or the prelude to World War One, where you have alliances and then a squabble breaks out over a pile of the rocks in the middle of the ocean and suddenly you find yourself at war. That's at stake. But in the short term, and as you've just mentioned, Alfred McCoy, this seems to have a lot to do with China's need for food. And it's just grabbing all of the fishing grounds, having fished out its own waters. There's already a dispute underway now between China and Indonesia because the Indonesian fishermen are furious that these massive thousands of they have fleets of thousands of fishing boats, which are, I believe, are coordinated by the Chinese Navy, have moved into Indonesian waters. And Indonesia is caught in the same position. On the one hand, its government makes deals with China, and money is obviously exchanged, but its own people, and particularly the fishermen, are furious. So is this what's going on, that China's sort of trying to buy and bribe its way into essentially becoming the hegemon?
Yes, and there's there, I think, are several major issues at stake in the South China Sea. First of all, there's the issue of China's, what China sees as its territorial sovereignty. Okay, China is one of those empires that expands overland to contiguous territories. It did it in Tibet right after the 1949 revolution, when Red Army forces went in there, forced the Dalai Lama out of power, took over that territory. And they're doing it now through this maritime means in the South China Sea. So that's one issue. And it appeals very strongly to Chinese nationalism and gives the Chinese government, particularly the Communist Party, enormous legitimacy with the Chinese people. So for domestic reasons, they can't back away from this strongly nationalist position, and they're not going to. The Communist Party's hold on China, I think, may be more tenuous than we imagine. The next thing is military defenses. China has a massive military. They're expanding into cyberspace, aerospace, and maritime power. They're shifting their military forces from being a massive land army with over 1 million soldiers. They're discharging soldiers. They're drawing down the size of their land army, and they're shifting into these more technological domains of military conflict. And this is part of that extension. China's built its first aircraft carrier, and the Pentagon estimates that by 2030, China will go from one aircraft carrier, the Pentagon didn't say how many, but a couple of dozen, so that China will always have an aircraft carrier in the South China Sea and be the only power to do so. So there's that layer. Then there's the control over commerce that passes through the South China Sea. It's about $5 trillion a year of international commerce that passes through that area. So this is one of the major areas of commerce that China can control. Next are hydrocarbons. It's believed that there are vast oil and gas deposits under the South China Sea. And China, although right now because of a $1 trillion investment in oil pipelines from Central Asia, has sufficient natural gas, and they're doing deals with Gazprom, the Russian one as well, but they're concerned about the future, their future energy needs, and this is right under their control. And finally, it's food. The average Chinese eats 80 pounds of fish a year. They eat more fish than any other major nation on the planet. They've fished out the northern end of the South China Sea, and they have a fishing fleet estimated at about 92,000 ships. And those ships are now moving into the richer areas of the South China Sea, near the Philippines, near the Malaysian state of Sabah, near the Indonesian waters, producing this host of conflicts. So those are all the issues at stake. And what that means is that for China, the South China Sea is extremely important and worth fighting for.
Well, just in closing then, Alfred McCoy, with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders making up today and the platform of the Democratic Party platform, which Bernie Sanders tried to shape, he got a number of concessions. He didn't get a concession on trade deals, the principal one being the TPP, which most people on the left in this country think of as a terrible repeat of NAFTA. But there is a geopolitical component to the TPP, which is tied in with Obama's tilt to Asia, which essentially organizes the nations in that neighborhood as a trading bloc, not so much to confront China or contain China. That's what they say, but it clearly is. And, you know, there's the option of China joining. And it would seem to me that the only way to curb China's hegemonic territorial ambitions would be to organize the neighborhood, because they, every time China flexes its muscles, the neighborhood gets nervous. So do you see the TPP as a part of a strategic effort to deal with China's ambitions?
Yeah. China, about 10 years ago, began to make clear its strategy for global dominion. As I said, China is one of those imperial powers that expands overland. And what they did is they invested $1 trillion to build a rail and gas pipeline network that can transform the vast Eurasian landmass, stretching from over 6,000 miles from Spain all the way to Siberia, to transform that into a unified landmass and the epicenter of a new world empire. And what Obama did in a stroke of geopolitical genius, nothing less, I use that term advisedly, a stroke of geopolitical genius, was Obama recognized the Chinese threat right away in the first part of his administration when Hillary Clinton was his Secretary of State. And it's known, his strategic response is known colloquially as the pivot to Asia. Secretary Clinton actually coined that term, but she was executing Obama's strategy. It has two parts. One is to pull American forces out of the miasma of the Middle East, the cesspit of blood and endless conflict. And now that there's a glut of oil, we don't need the oil, and we certainly don't need the conflict. So just pull our forces out of that where there's nothing to be gained, and shift them geopolitically to a literal stretching, an island literal off the shore of Asia, stretching from Japan all the way down through the South China Sea to Australia. And second, and this is Obama's masterstroke, to negotiate the two greatest trade treaties ever. One, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which we've just been talking about, which is going to drain, if passed, 40% of the world's trade towards the United States. And then the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership with the EU, that, and this is much less likely, but if that one goes through, there's about another 20% of world trade. that could be drained from the western end of China's would-be world island, its would-be Eurasian landmass. So effectively, these two treaties are splitting that world island right down the middle of the Urals and draining the Asiatic trade east across the Pacific to the United States and the European or the western part of that continent's trade across the Atlantic to America, and draining that economic substance out of the world island and thus defeating China's trillion-dollar geopolitical strategy. And since Secretary Clinton understood the geopolitics of this, because she was executing Obama's strategy, it's very likely when she's elected president that she will actually find a way to get both of these trade treaties to get pushed through and to continue that military pivot to East Asia.
Well, Alfred McCoy, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian. Pleasure to talk.
And likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Alfred McCoy, who holds a Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the editor of Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, America's Decline, and the author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, among other works. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the confusion and danger that the open carry laws in Texas posed for Dallas police officers and the impact that the open carry law in Ohio will have on next week's Republican convention in Cleveland.
Nung isilang ka sa mundong ito, laking tuwa ng magulang mo at ang kamay nilang iyong ilaw. At ang nanay at tatay mo'y di malaman ang gagawin.
Happiness is a warm gun. Happiness is a warm gun, mama. When I hold you in my arms and I feel my finger on
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is John Donahue III, a professor of law at Stanford Law School and a research associate with the National Bureau of Economic Research. He has written numerous publications on gun control policy and is the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Donahue.
Great to be here.
And I would say that the recent events, particularly the shooting of Philando Castile in St. Paul, Minnesota, does shoot down the more guns, less crime hypothesis, because the NRA has always said that the more guns we have, the more secure we are and the safer we are. Yet the reason that the young African-American man was killed beside his girlfriend and a 4-year-old child in the back seat by the police officer in Minnesota was, and by the way, the lawyer for this police officer has verified this, was because of the mere possession of a concealed weapon. So, in other words, rather stark evidence that the possession of guns does not make you safe. It actually attracts violence rather than reduces it.
The whole gun question is getting a lot of reconsideration in light of recent events. For years, as you mentioned, I have been sort of mentioning the adverse consequences that occur when people are carrying around guns, and the NRA will cite the relatively rare incidents where someone is effectively able to use guns for successful self-defense. But regulatory policy can't be made on the relatively few benign cases, but has to look at the entire picture. And as you state, in a world where lots of people are carrying around guns, everybody is quicker to shoot and kill. And that goes from police officers to robbers, which is one reason why robbery is much more dangerous in the United States than it is in, say, England or European countries where guns are less prevalent.
So the NRA seems to be a little bit lost in terms of the way to respond to this rash of police shootings, starting in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, then St. Paul, Minnesota, and then Dallas, Texas. They've sort of had conflicting statements. What do you make of their confusion?
Well, this has happened before, essentially after the Columbine shooting in a Colorado high school a number of years ago. The NRA came out and said very firmly they were in favor of universal background checks. But then as the situation stabilized and their political power grew, they backed away from that and now say things like anyone who's in favor of universal background checks is an enemy of the Second Amendment. So they basically will just tack and weave to achieve their goals, but there is virtually never any honesty or consistency in NRA statements. And so we will just have to see if the pressure continues on them and we move in the direction of laws and regulatory changes that the American public overwhelmingly wants, or whether the NRA will, you know, get its back up and continue to block common sense regulatory measures in this area.
Well, clearly the Minnesota shooting does call into question the utility of concealed carry. If indeed the victim did tell the police officer that he had a concealed carry permit, and just we don't know, because the video that the woman in the car shot begins after he's been shot, so we don't know exactly what happened prior to that. But it does seem as if, you know, the mere sight of the gun was enough to have the policeman open fire. And we also know of the tremendous confusion that police officers in Dallas had when, in the midst of a peaceful protest against police violence, suddenly a sniper starts shooting policemen. And there, in the midst of these protests, because Texas is an open carry state, a number of people were walking around with assault rifles, which is perfectly legal. And the police were in a total state of confusion as to know who was shooting at them. And a number of these people were grabbed with their assault rifles and subdued, which again raises this question of what is the purpose of open carry? And now it's become a major question because of the Republican convention that begins next week. Ohio is an open carry state, and there are already gun rights advocates wandering around the convention center with their assault rifles, asserting their right to open carry. So I think a lot of people are beginning to feel like, you know, the country's going crazy here, that this push for gun rights has reached a point where it's incredibly counterproductive.
Yes, indeed. We've been in this place before. You know, interestingly, the right sort of lionizes Ronald Reagan, but when citizens started carrying openly, dangerous weapons on the streets of California, he, as governor, pushed through a law to block open carry of rifles. And so California is not an open carry state because of Ronald Reagan. And I think many people, as you said, are realizing the dangers that it presents, because you do have very zealous individuals who think that they are achieving some important goal by carrying around assault weapons, but all they are doing is, creating the potential for mayhem that we saw in Dallas, and certainly in a political convention of this degree of controversy. The last thing that anyone wants, and as the police have said, the last thing they want to see is people carrying around those sorts of assault weapons. It makes the job of the police that much harder because trying to differentiate between a zealous advocate of the Second Amendment and a crazed homicidal killer is going to be a very delicate and tricky judgment.
So what do you think is going to happen then in terms of what's going on in or what's about to go on in Cleveland as a lot of people are expected to show up this weekend beginning on Sunday? And, of course, there'll be protesters in the streets around the convention site, as well as supporters of Donald Trump in this open carry state. And a member of the Cleveland City Council has said, a member of the Cleveland City Council Safety Committee has said that everybody is on edge after Dallas. So the very site, which we'll be seeing soon on our television sets, are people wandering around with military-style weapons, is unsettling in itself in a country that's at peace. I mean, I don't understand how it's gotten this far that we have become such a militarized society. I know there's a book out by Pamela Haag that called The Gunning of America that takes the position that the reason that she's an historian that takes the position the reason we have so many guns in America is essentially that the gun manufacturers have done an extraordinary job of promoting their product and making it as a necessary part of the household as a kettle and a frying pan.
Yeah, it's been a great marketing job, and they have managed to sort of follow the pattern of the tobacco industry to get pseudoscience leveraged to their benefit, and they've also managed to largely take over the Republican Party at the political level around the state and certainly in Congress, which has made it a very powerful obstacle to sensible policy in this area. As I said, the American people are almost uniformly in favor of universal background checks to try to keep guns away from criminals and the severely mentally disabled, yet the NRA is able to stop that. There are large majorities in favor of returning to the assault weapons ban that was in place for 10 years starting in 1994, yet the NRA blocks that. And then, of course, we have irresponsible citizens who are taking these freedoms to do things like carry around assault weapons in public places where, political actors are present and political confrontation is high. There really is no conceivable reason to have open carry of assault weapons. It's really insane. And you saw that in Dallas, when you had a guy with an assault weapon start shooting, you had 11 police officers shooting back at him, and they needed a bomb to finally take him out. I mean, it's a ridiculous situation, and hopefully our leaders are going to stop being so cravenly subordinate to NRA wishes in this area and follow the Democratic position that most people want some reasonable gun control.
Well, apparently the Secret Service, first of all, there was an effort to allow for the open carry of guns within the Quicken Loans arena itself, where the Republican convention is going to be held next week. That, of course, was shot down by the Secret Service, who set up a kind of perimeter. But it's a pretty narrow perimeter, my understanding, around the Quicken Loans arena. And there's a group of former military members called the Oath Keepers who have said they're going to show up heavily armed and carry their weapons at the and around the Quicken Loans arena in Cleveland. So this is all going to happen next week, it would seem. Where's the adult in the room here? Certainly not Donald Trump, from what I can tell. He boasts of the fact that he has an open carry or concealed carry permit. And he said that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it.
Yeah, his statements have not been helpful. I was glad that the Secret Service immediately put to rest the idea that you should have guns in the convention, convention center. But as you mentioned, that is a more narrowly circumscribed area. So there will be guns very close to the action, and all it takes is one sort of crazed lunatic to start shooting, and boy, you're going to have problems galore if that happens. I would be apprehensive about this. In general, it's sort of low probability that one particular event will be targeted, but the chances are that if there is a nut in that area, this might be a vehicle for them to make a statement. And if they start shooting and you've got a lot of people with assault weapons running around, it's going to make the job that much tougher for police. And also, the Dallas police deserve some credit for not taking out some of these guys carrying the assault weapons, because as we saw in St. Paul, when firing starts or guns are present, people pull the triggers a lot more quickly. And so the dangers are clearly going to be there.
Well, it does make give one pause as to where we're heading. And I spoke recently with the historian on the Second Amendment, Saul Cornell, mm-hmm. who made the point that he doesn't think anything's going to change in this country with this tyranny of the minority, where you've only got 5.5 million members of the NRA, yet they have the entire Republican House of Representatives in their pocket and cowering before their every dictate. Then you heard recently the Democrats staged a sit-in, which doesn't appear to have yielded anything. And they didn't resume it when the House came back into office. Came back after the 4th of July recess. So that was a strange lack of I think, commitment there on the part of the Democrats. I don't know what they got out of it. As far as I know, they haven't gotten anything out of it so far. Do you think that is the case? I mean, how do the majority in this country build a movement that will intimidate the Congress as much as they are by the NRA? Because only when the gun safety lobby scares these congressmen as much as the NRA does, will we ever have change.
Yeah, it's a very unfortunate situation we've gotten ourselves into, where the Republicans have managed to gerrymander districts so that they keep a lot of safe seats for themselves, and the NRA sort of dictates what their policies will be in this arena. So I do think, though, that while we're in a bad political stalemate at this point, the one area of gun violence that continues to be going up are these mass shootings. And I can see a change in attitudes that people are becoming more fed up. And it really is going to take, a demonstration of will by the people at large to put pressure on essentially the Republicans. The Democratic votes are there for action, but right now both houses of Congress are controlled by the Republicans, and in the Senate you need 60 votes to get any action through. So you really do need the people to rise up. Right now they're willing to express their desire for reasonable gun control measures, but they have to do more than merely articulate that in national opinion polls. They have to be willing to penalize the congressional figures that are standing in the way of that action.
Well, President Bill Clinton blames the 2000 He blames the 1994 loss of the House to the assault weapons ban. He came in 92, and then the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate and the White House, and then 2 years later, Newt Gingrich came in. And Clinton blames the wipeout in the House for the Democrats on the assault weapons ban. So I don't know where we stand on that politically, whether gun control measures are the kiss of death. Because here in the state of California, the Lieutenant Governor, Gavin Newsom, has insisted on keeping a gun control measure on the November ballot here in California, even though the California legislature passed and Governor Brown signed similar gun control measures, if not identical ones. So the question is, is Gavin Newsom just grandstanding because he wants to become the governor? And will having this proposition, this gun control proposition on the ballot, will it cost all other progressive measures on the ballot because all of the gun rights people are going to come out and vote as they do because they're highly organized? So what's your expectation for the California ballot in November?
It's certainly worrisome to think that the California ballot might go down because it invigorates some of these zealous, NRA-type citizens. So I am worried about that. On the other hand, it does provide an opportunity, perhaps, for the rest of California, which is by far the majority, to step up and make a serious statement along these lines. I would have been happier, I think, if the Gavin Newsom measure had been withdrawn, because I think virtually all of what he was trying to achieve was legislatively adopted. And, California has been doing well in reducing gun violence relative to the rest of the country. And one way in which you can maybe change minds nationally is if our continued efforts to control guns reveals the benefits of that. Obviously, it will never be as good as national legislation, because Californians will be victims of Arizona and Nevada easy gun laws. But we are seeing that the gun measures here are reducing overall gun deaths. And if that continues, hopefully that message will get out and, persuade more and more Americans to stand up for reasonable measures.
Well, John Donahue, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with John Donahue, who's a professor of law at Stanford Law School and a research associate with the National Bureau of Economic Research. He has written numerous publications on gun control policy and is the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.